And yes, we are on air. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay, we are live. Hello, this is Joseph Aleo, and you're listening to Mage the Podcast. This is the podcast dedicated to all things Mage. And on today's show, we're going to be talking to Charles Siegel, who's the author of The Enlightened Grimoire, which can be found on the Storyteller's Vault. I'm very excited. It's got, oh, I'm going to say over 50 pages of rotes that you can use for your campaign, for your chronicle. But before we do, I just wanted to briefly talk about this game I'm working on. It's actually not a game. It's more of a setting. It's called The Soft Apocalypse, and it's based off an idea from Will McIntosh's book. And the idea is, in all the movies and books you see, it usually starts post-apocalypse, or the bombs drop or something like that, and then the apocalypse. And this one, he says, well, what if it took several decades for the apocalypse to get here? And I thought that was a very fascinating idea. So I started doing some research into the game. And it got depressing as hell, because if you do believe in climate change and all the things that happens, to me, the thing that is the biggest signifier that we're really screwed is that in about 2040 or 2050, 90% of the coral reefs will die, and they supply anywhere from 50 to 80% of the world's oxygen. So if that indeed happens, well, it's literally game over. So yeah, the research for the game is very, very depressing. But let's go on the assumption that we're all going to live. So right now I'm looking for a game mechanic to run it. So I've been thinking about Strain, which is what runs Zaasrekala, maybe Fate, maybe Savage Worlds, GURPS, or Simple World, which is a hack of the powered by the apocalypse. So that's what I'm doing. If you have any suggestions, let me know. I've got a common book where I'm keeping all my ideas that I can share with you. I'm very happy to do it. But enough said. We're here to talk about The Enlightened Grimoire, and we're joined by Charles Siegel. Charles, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for asking.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. We've been trying to make this interview happen for, oh, I don't know, a month, maybe 2 months, and I'm really, really, really happy to have you on the show. When I had Josh Heath on the show a couple months ago, he mentioned The Enlightened Grimoire, and he said that you took all the rotes that have been in all the editions and put it all in one book, and Seteros was very happy about that because that was something he was going to do, and you took the load off of him. So, very briefly, what is The Enlightened Grimoire?
It is, well, as you said, it's a collection of all of the rotes that have been published through all four editions of Mage for the last 25 years. Comes in at about 1,500 rotes and is just over 200 pages.
That is quite an undertaking. What led to that decision to put this book together, and how long did it take you?
So, and this actually goes back to some games that I ran in the early to mid 2000s, where the Ascension book had been published, but there were, dozens and dozens of books, that everything of Mage was scattered across. A problem that I'm sure that quite a few people had run into before Mage 20 actually collected everything. And my players were confused. So we ended up making a big spreadsheet with, at the time, what I thought were all the rotes because I hadn't been careful, and it was around 600 or 700 of them that they could use to search out what things they could do with the various spheres that they had. So when Werewolf came to Storyteller's Vault, I was talking to a friend of mine who has published vampire things, goes by Secrets of the Masquerade. And she had seen some of these things when we were talking about Mage, and knew that I had them, and suggested that for Mage, I should, when it gets released, I should see if it's okay to, take all the rotes, update them to current rules, and release them. So I talked to the people behind the Storyteller's Vault. They liked the idea, and I spent a very, very intensive 3 weeks finding out that I had underestimated how many rotes there were by about 1,000.
Oh my God. So 3 weeks to find out that you had underestimated, but how long did it take you to actually write this book?
So yeah, I did the whole thing in about 3 weeks. It was almost all of my nights and weekends. It helped that I had already written a smaller version, years ago, but I had to go back and make sure everything was right, update them to current, and so on. But yeah, it was, as I said, 3 very intense weeks.
Now, the book is actually divided up into sections. There's elementals, there's necromancy. Could you give us could you flesh it out a little bit further? Tell us what's in the book actually, in terms of the sections it's divided up into.
Give me a moment to pull up the book because
Of
the
course, I'm
front
so
of
sorry.
my and originally I was doing it kind of as a companion to How Do You Do That, which explains how to do everything in very but often and often very specific, but didn't contain like separated out rotes. Everything's there mixed into the text, and it works very well. But considering the pile of rotes that already existed, I thought something more like this would work. And then it turned out that the rotes in, 2.5 decades of Mage don't actually fit nicely into the same classification that How Do You Do That uses. So I ended up starting from there and then building on it. I've got a bunch of chapters, and I still had to throw in a miscellaneous for the weird things that just don't really fit anywhere else. Probably the ones that I get the most use out of are, say, summoning, binding, and warding, which actually does follow How Do You Do That quite closely. Movement and communication is another favorite of mine. And the computer section is always fun because I do computers. I work with computers for a living. I do research in AI.
Fascinating. So, did you have to consult anyone at, say, White Wolf or Onyx Path or anyone on the various message boards to bring all these spells up to date?
I did talk to people at White Wolf to just a second. I spoke to Shane to Shane. I'm to Shane DeFriest, in large part to find out if this was even a permissible project because it's not really original. It wasn't really original work.
Oh, that's a good point.
But they seemed really happy with the idea, and I didn't consult with anyone really during that 3 weeks. But way back, I was actually part of the brain trust for How Do You Do That, so I have kind of been involved in making sure that the magic rules were consistent for Mage 20.
So aside from gathering all the material, what was the biggest challenge of putting this book together?
Well, the spheres have actually changed quite a bit from edition to edition. A ver so, one example that's particularly stark is a lot of situations in Mage can be resolved pretty quickly if you can just look at someone's avatar. This is a kind of a perfect Nefandis detector, for instance. So, what spheres you need to do that have changed quite a bit. It's currently Mind 3, Prime 2, Spirit 1. In the past, I've had people at least infer that it's Spirit 1. Revised explicitly says it's Spirit 5, which is the same thing you need to kill an avatar. So just that one effect is all over the place between editions, and other things change too.
So, yourself, are you more of a player or are you more of a storyteller?
I am generally more of an ST. Just as a rule, I really do a lot. I really like a lot of world building and handling the rules stuff, and often try to make things as rules light for the players while still having it actually be mage.
So when putting this game together, which rotes did you notice that came up time and time again that your players would use the most?
Um, So I think across all the games I've run since I started playing, the single rote that my players have used the most is a mind three effect to put someone to sleep.
I could see that. And do you have a personal favorite rote?
Oh, that's a hard one. And I tend to like a lot, I tend to personally like some of the weird ones,
Oh yeah, like
like the
what?
super specific ones. Sorry, I'm tabbing through trying to remember specific things.
I imagine, because there's so many of them.
And I tend to play when I play I tend to play spirit mages, so a lot of some of the summoning stuff and binding and a lot of the stuff that really keys into real world mythology and mysticism Bottle of gin from Lost Paths, Ali Bateen and Taftani. It's the technique that the Taftani used to capture spirits in bottles for later use.
Love it. So I'm curious, what's your attraction to the spirit mages?
So when I first started playing, just fresh out of Dungeons and Dragons and getting into Mage, it was straight up power gaming.
Of course.
You're telling me that if I just focus on this one sphere, I can get other things to do what I want instead of having to figure out how to do it myself? So turns out that the price is higher.
Well, this leads me to a question that I ask everybody who appears in the show. How did you get into role-playing games, and how did that lead to Mage? What's the love of Mage? So let's start off with how you got into role-playing games.
So, around the end of the time I was in elementary school, a friend of mine just showed up at school one day with his parents' old D&D books. And said, "Hey, I have this game. We're going to play it." And we did.
That's amazing for elementary school kids.
And this was right at the end. We were 9 or 10-ish. And all of us were kind of, all of us were geeks of some kind. I was more on the math and science, and this friend was more on the English lit end, as much as you can be at age 9. And it ended up just working out. The first game that we played was basically Lord of the Rings with higher magic and more stabbings.
Now that sounds like a fun game. But so being a math guy, what was it that appealed to you in a game that's more high fantasy?
Well, first off, you'll find very quickly that most math and science people grow up on a steady diet of fantasy and science fiction.
True.
At the start, part of it was just I loved the dice. The rules were complicated enough that if I really worked at it, I could find fun examples and ways to put it all together. And we were just kids doing ridiculous things.
Well, Charles, when I was playing Dungeons and Dragons and Villains and Vigilantes with my friends, there was one guy who was very much into math and physics, and he always slowed the game down because he's like, no, that's not the way physics would work. And then we'd have to hammer out some house rules to satisfy him. Were you that kind of guy?
No, you generally speaking, I let the rules speak for them. Like, suspension of disbelief is really helpful when playing or running a role-playing game.
Now, see, I would have loved to have played with you then.
Now, I get into those arguments a lot more in Mage, I was actually just telling some people recently about a time that I actually sat down and did quantum mechanical calculations with a friend of mine to prove that their character could not do something without getting paradox, because just because you're a technocrat doesn't mean that you're immune to paradox.
All right, there we go. So tell me, all right, so you started playing Dungeons and Dragons. How did that lead to Mage?
So around 97 or 98, one of my friends got his hands on Vampire Second Edition, and we attempted to play it, and it really did not work for our group. I'm still not quite sure what it was, but in the end, none of us could get into the characters, just nothing. But we liked the idea so much, we just couldn't make it work for us. So then we went back to D&D for a couple of years, and then hanging out at the comic book shop, they had when in '99 they got the Mage: The Ascension Revised, and they actually had that really expensive limited edition version. And for about a year, I was staring at it because it's such a pretty book, but I couldn't afford it because I was in high school. And
Yeah, that'll do it.
if I remember right, that book was like $100, and this was all the way back in like 90 in 99.
Whoa, that's so expensive.
And it was a beautiful book, but eventually they got in regular copies of Mage Revised, and of course I bought one the day that they opened that box. Because I can finally see what's inside that book I can't afford. And I took it home, I read it cover to cover, and I told my friends, "Hey, we're playing this game." And it was a complete disaster.
Oh, what happened?
Oh, just none of us had any concept of paradigm or paradox or what was plausible. It was what a mage game looked like if it's being played by a bunch of 14-year-old boys who don't know anything. So, for instance, a virtual adept yelling computer code in order to cause buildings on the MIT campus to dance.
So how long did
We
it
got
take you to
better.
get so how long did it take you to finally get a grip on the game?
So we kept bouncing back and forth between Dungeons and Dragons and further attempts at Mage while I was in high school, and eventually it started getting better. Our games were still very, very over the top, not at all in the tone that Mage Revised tries to strike, which is the more local, smaller conflicts and so on. But then, as I graduated high school, I ended up playing on a big chat site, and it was kind of organized like how LARPs are organized, but online instead of everyone having to get together and spending a weekend doing it. It was online, continuous, and persistent, and I really loved that. So I started playing. From what other people told me, I very quickly became one of the dominant player character presences, and after about a year or so, I ended up being the mage ST on the site, and actually most of the games I've played since then are in some way descended from that one.
No, I recently saw a post on Facebook. I think it's for the Travelers role-playing game group, and the person was relating that when they were kids, when they would play games, it's all about plundering and looting and shooting people. But now that they're all in their 30s and 40s, and they're all professionals and they're all attorneys or engineers, they notice that in their games there is a lot of fixation on the legalities of the matter or what the actual physics are. And so now the games are much, well, it reflects who they are as adults. So how has your approach to being a storyteller changed from when you were, say, a 14-year-old to, I'm going to imagine that you're in your late 30s now?
I am 33.
33. So how has your approach to storytelling changed in that time?
So yeah, when I was at 10, it was all about killing things, lighting things on fire, and making off with the loot. Now, tends to have a lot more esoteric philosophy and mysticism, but also things like what makes a good relationship.
Oh, that's interesting. All right, so what makes a good relationship, at least in your game?
Well, the most important thing really to me is that the characters have to both choose it. They have to mean it. And this is also to me one of the big themes of Mage, that reality is what you make of it. Everything is what you make of it.
So when you say they have to choose it and they have to mean it, what exactly do you mean by that?
So a lot of my games end up being about choices. So very little actually happens against what the players decide to do. Almost everything is driven by what the players choose to do and what the consequences of those things are. And sometimes things happen because the players decide that the consequences weren't worth it and give up on something. So that's kind of what I mean. You have to kind of pick something, and then you have to decide that you're actually committed to it, that you're keeping going on, they're keeping on the course, that things are still going to keep working, and you have to be willing to put in the effort. And that's not just true of in-game relationships. This is just important in general.
So once you've sort of set that as a role, how do the players interact with that?
So you I've generally gotten pretty good responses from my players. Like everyone knows where I make sure everyone knows where boundaries are. But as I said, my games are generally driven by the players and their characters and their goals, 'cause mages are people who have very strong desires, very strong well, to use a term from Wraith, passions. Things that they really, really want to do. And to me, a game that doesn't focus on what the characters are trying to accomplish, rather than putting them in the reactive role of, oh, there's some villain of the week, how do they deal with this? To me, that's kind of missing the point of what makes mages special.
So in your games, in your chronicles, is it more of a personal street level game, or is it epic in scope, or somewhere in between?
It's somewhere in between. I try to do a microcosm macrocosm thing where the big grand things are reflected in the personal things and vice versa. But I'm going to be honest, I ST a lot on the fly, and it's very hard to do those things without a lot of planning in advance.
Yeah, I would imagine. And now, are you doing this in person at like a house or at a game store, or are you playing online?
So the vast majority of my gaming is online.
All right, well, let's bring this back to the Grimoire then. Do you have it available as like a searchable database that all the players can access?
Right now my players have the book, the same that anyone else can pick up. I keep intending to make a searchable database out of it, but there's only so many hours in the day, and I have other Storyteller's Vault projects I want to do.
Oh, well, let's talk about those other projects. So, what do you have in mind, or is it too early to talk about them?
Well, I'm actually planning on ideally, towards the end of this month or beginning of next month, releasing a book I'm calling The Mystic Armory, which is all of the wonders for the last 25 years.
Oh, boy, you sure know how to pick the epic projects, don't you?
Well, here's my rule of thumb.
Let's hear it.
If this would help me run a game, I want it.
All right, that makes perfect sense to me.
So I make the things that I want, and if I'm thinking about something and I'm not sure, I send a message to any of several friends of mine and ask, "Hey, is this a thing that would be helpful to you?" So I use my friends for market research. And if my friends say, "Yeah, that'd be great, I'd love that," then put it in my to-do pile, which is something like 17 books long now, so probably not all of them are going to happen.
All right, well, let me ask you a very, very obvious question. Now that you've got the grimoire underneath your belt, what have you learned from putting this book together that you would apply to future projects, and what would you tell to other aspiring writers, some pitfalls to avoid or some things that they'd want to pursue to make their experience easier?
So I guess the biggest things to avoid are thinking that your project is going to be easier to put together than it is. Don't underestimate how much time it will take. Leave yourself plenty of time because you probably don't want to be spending 40 hours a week at your day job and then 40 or 50 hours a week writing the book. Just to hit some deadline that you a deadline you picked. I only had the deadline because I had agreed to have it ready for the launch day of Mage on the Storyteller's Vault. But if schedules slip, it's better to have schedule slippage than a bad product or to stress yourself out terribly. As far as more positive advice, things to do rather than things not to do. It seems like people on the Storyteller's Vault do generally pr like mechanics books, things that they can actually bring to bear on at their table. And right now, Mage doesn't have very much, and I know several people who just automatically buy everything that comes out for Mage because there's not much. So if you have a good idea for Mage, go at it.
Yeah, I'm really hoping the Storyteller's Vault will rectify that situation. Now, one last question. Actually, two last questions before we wrap this up. Were there any tools that you use specifically to put your book together? I'm assuming you use some sort of spreadsheet, but in terms of writing, were you just using Word or what were you using?
So I actually mostly used Scrivener. The little notes were very helpful. I made each wrote into a note, and then I played with various organization schemes and so on as I went. And then after that, I took all the text, I copied it into Word, and started working on the formatting. Which I also underestimated how much time it would take.
Yeah, I bet. Well, Scrivener—that's a hardcore writing app. It's usually for screenwriters and professional writers. Did you have that beforehand, or did you buy that specifically for this book?
I had it beforehand, partly because I use Scrivener to keep track of my notes for games.
Ah, that's a very interesting idea. I like that. So, one of the things we discussed before we arranged this interview was giving away a copy of The Enlightened Grimoire. So let's talk about that very briefly now. So what I'm going to do is that if you're listening to the show and you would like your chance to win this copy, you can send us an email at magethepodcast@gmail.com. I will also post this on Twitter and Facebook. And if you see it there, respond there. And what I will do in a week's time is I will randomly choose a lucky winner. And you will have a copy of The Enlightened Grimoire. And it clocks in at, how many pages is this thing with? 60, 70 pages?
211.
Oh my God, 211? For some reason, I just thought it was much shorter than that, but 211, that is huge. And here's the other thing. When I was talking to Josh Heath, he was recommending that people keep their submissions to something to about 11 to 15 pages. But something like this, it warrants having that many pages. Did they give you any specific direction and length when you were submitting this?
No, they told me more or less what reasonable price pay points per page were. But otherwise, it's completely open. I looked, I saw that most of the stuff for Vampire and Werewolf were in the 30 to 50 page range. I guess this is something I have in common with Satyros, that I can't stay in a reasonable page range.
Well, it's clearly a passion project,
It's
so
Mage.
I'm so happy that you sunk your heart into this. Now, if we would like to keep abreast with future projects that you will be working on, where can they find you in the Storyteller's Vault?
On the Storyteller's Vault, currently, Enlightened Grimoire is the most popular thing on the Storyteller's. Oh no, I'm down to number two.
Oh no!
for the first time since like 2 days after release, I'm quite happy to see that I'm being beaten by a new mage book, though.
Oh, what's a new book?
Paradox the Brainstorming, which I have not looked at yet.
Okay, well, I'm sure after this show we'll put you back at number one, but I'm glad that other people are having their chance to shine.
Oh, yeah. I have been completely overwhelmed by the reception that Enlightened Grimoire has gotten. Before I posted it, I told my wife that I'd be happy if it sold 10 copies.
So what did your wife think when you were sinking all this time writing the book?
My wife thought that it's going to be very useful to her because she's one of my mage players.
Oh, that's really fantastic. Well, you know, Charles, I really enjoyed talking to you. And when you complete your future projects, I would love to have you back on the show to talk about them.
Of course.
All right. Well, before we go, please join us again next week. Adam Simpson will be returning, and he will be continuing his Tomes of Magic segment. And next week, he will be discussing the Book of Chantries, which is very exciting. You can find us online at magethepodcast.com. You can follow us on Twitter at magethepodcast. And please subscribe to Mage the Podcast on iTunes, Google Play, and now in the TuneIn app. And give us a review or rating on iTunes, because I'm sure if you listen to podcasts, you've heard many people say this before, but it helps in the algorithm and it pops us up further if people are interested in Mage. So for Mage the Podcast and Charles Siegel, I'm Joseph Leo. Thanks for listening. See you next week.